session number 20515, Reel 1.
Norman Brinley, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Birkenhead, in Cheshire. That's on Merseyside.
Which year was this?
1919.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Birkenhead?
Yes, yes. I lived in Birkenhead until the war.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school at Rock Ferry High... Well, I went, first of all, of course, in the junior school, and that was in Woodchurch Road School in Birkenhead, and then I went to Rock Ferry High School.
How old were you when you finished there?
I was 18.
So that was in 37?
Yes.
What did you then do?
Well, I went to Chester Teachers Training College to train as a teacher, which was a two-year course, so it was due to finish in 1939.
And did you anticipate at that time that a war was coming?
Well, not at the time when I went there, but of course, before I'd finished, we were pretty sure that there was going to be a war coming.
Did you hear Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Oh, yes. We heard the announcement on the radio, yes, and then we listened to his speech. And I was with my sister then, and her children, and my mother. My father had died about 3 months earlier. And we knew then that it was going. And it was shortly after that, I think, that the announcement came, the government is preparing for a four-year war. And we thought, 1943, that's a long, long way off.
How did you feel? How did you and your family feel about the declaration of war?
Well, it was pretty obvious it was coming. And in a way, well, certainly I was glad that it had come to it, partly because it got rid of the uncertainty, and we knew it was on. And also because I was so much then anti-fascist, anti-Nazi, that I thought we must stop this as soon as we can. And I thought that's what the war was going to do.
What had moulded your anti-Nazi opinions?
Sorry, what had moulded?
What had moulded your anti-Nazi opinions?
Well, it's actually started, I think, when the Italians invaded Abyssinia. And I remember hearing Count Ciano laughing as he described how they dropped mustard gas on the very ill-armed, ill-protected Abyssinians. And I thought that was dreadful, and this must be something wrong with this government that does that. And then, of course, the Spanish Civil War and the Germans and the Italians actually taking part in that. It wasn't, we didn't really understand yet then about the anti-Jewish attitude, at least I didn't, of the Nazis. But certainly everything that they seemed to stand for was something I found abhorrent. And so I was glad that we were starting to try and get rid of it.
Had you been politically committed pre-war, in that you joined something?
Not really, no, not officially. I did have friends who were members of the Communist Party. And, in fact, I did go in 1939, before the war started. I was over in Liverpool in the, I think, the Easter vacation it would be, and was selling the Daily Worker on Lime Street. And a bit further up the road were the black shirts selling their newspaper of which they call Action. And in fact, I bought a copy of Action just to see what sort of thing they were saying. And in fact, all the paper was doing was attacking the government. And I felt some of the things they said I actually had to agree with, although I was still very much against the fascists.
Was there any physical conflict between the communists and the black shirts?
Not where I was concerned, no. Yeah.
How strong were the black shirts in Liverpool?
Well, they were there, and everybody knew they were there, and they certainly took plenty of action, but I don't remember any physical action at all. They were doing a lot of propaganda.
What particular points about government policy had you agreed with them about?
Well, the headline was called Pecksniffian Politics, and really it was not putting forward any of the fascist ideas. It was simply knocking the government for being so hypocritical, and I felt that in some ways the government was hypocritical, saying one thing and then doing something different.
Was this about the attitude towards Germany, you mean?
Not so much there, no. I think just in general policy, domestic policy as much as anything. But I really was not very much into that aspect. It was the idea, it was being against fascism that I was felt strongly.
So did the war affect you at first once it had been declared?
Well, it did. As I said, it was partly because the government had arranged for military service for all men aged 20. And in fact, we had to sign up. I was at Chester College then, and we had to sign up at the City Hall in Chester. And it so happened that that was a day when we had one of our final examinations set by Liverpool University. And so it was arranged that all those aged 20 would go to the City Hall early and register, which we did. So it might mean that I was the first peacetime conscript to register. I certainly wasn't the first to be called up, but I went early before anybody else to register there. So I knew that I was going to have to do this. And, of course, at that time, I was applying for posts, teaching posts, and the regulations about the military service was that the employer would have to continue to pay the salary or wages of the conscript. And so when I applied for a job, they said, well, will you apply again after you've done your military service? They didn't want to start off by paying 6 months' salary to somebody who wasn't doing anything for them. So I didn't get a post there. So it certainly affected me in that way. And then, of course, I knew that I would be going into the army. And this was after war had declared that I went in. So I knew it obviously wasn't going to be just 6 months.
When were you called to the colours?
That was not until October. Actually, I think that somewhere in my military record it says September, but it was actually the beginning of October that I was called to go to Satan Camp, that's near Chester. And it was into the heavy anti-aircraft. And when I got there, of course, there were lots of different sort of people, men from different walks of life, nearly all from Merseyside. But there was one chap who came from a farm, and when he learned that the rally was at 6:30, he was delighted to have a lie-in until 6:30. He'd been so used to getting up at sort of 5 o'clock in the morning. But there were a lot of different sort of people, and I made friends with John Craigie, who was a commercial artist from Liverpool. And we were quite close then. Sorry, where were we? What were we?
I think you've given a description of what you looked like as a young militiaman being called up.
Oh, yes, that's right. Well, we had... we were dressed in... What was it? The original militiamen in peacetime had black berets and black blazers and grey flannel trousers. And, of course, we had our regulation uniform. I was delighted, actually, to find that we didn't have the putties that they had in the First World War, but we had gaiters, which were much easier to put on. Some of the things I remember, that very first day we went in for a meal, we marched to the canteen, and we sat down at tables, 12 to a table. It was a square table, 3 on each side. And the orderly came and put down a big dish of food in the middle and various other things. And everybody reached out and grabbed food. We had our plates and our knives and forks with us. And some of them didn't get any. And somebody called out to the orderly, "Can we have some more?" And he just gave a very sarcastic laugh. So, the next time we went to a meal, John Craig and I went in together, and I took hold of a table knife, and he took over the serving spoons, and he started to deal it out. And when any hands came out, I stabbed down with my knife. And actually, we did share it out very fairly then. And after that, we didn't have any problems. Everybody knew that we were in it together, and we had to help each other and be fair. So that was all right.
How did you cope with the training?
The training? Oh. Well, that was all right. All the NCOs, and I think probably the officers there too, they'd all been regular soldiers, I think, who had retired but had been recalled to the colours when the war was declared. And I remember our troop sergeant, who was a Devonshire man, very nice chap actually. We bought him a cigarette lighter at the end of our course. But we always tell us how to stand to attention with the fists slightly Frenched, he would say. We knew that he meant either lightly clenched or slightly clenched, or perhaps tightly clenched. We never did find out. But he was a very nice chap. And then there was the sergeant major, the battery sergeant major, who was regularly telling us that he was going to be commissioned as a captain quartermaster. Now, I found out afterwards that a captain quartermaster is a rank which is very often given to former warrant officers, and tended to be rather looked down upon by other officers. They weren't quite the right thing. But anyway, he was going to be a captain quartermaster. And he decided one day that he would give us a lecture on map reading. And he started off by pointing out that the magnetic north that you saw on a compass was not the same as true north. And he said, and to put in a correction, he said, when it's to the west, you add the magnetic difference, and when it's to the east, you subtract it. Well, I stood up and said, excuse me, Sergeant Major, I think you add it all the time. And he looked at me. He'd obviously never been contradicted by a recruit. So he turned to a sergeant, fetch me a manual of military map reading. So off went the sergeant, and he said, what were you before you came in the army? I said, I was a schoolmaster. Mm. The manual of military map reading was brought back, and he looked at it, and then he said, schoolmaster's right, I owe you a pint. But I never got the pint. But I think that might have given some idea about me to the powers that be. Another thing that happened, we were eventually given 7 days leave. And now, when I'd been at college in Chester, we had, at holiday time, when we were going on vacation, we used to book a coach. And it would take us, because most of the students came from Merseyside, it would go through Birkenhead and on to Liverpool and drop people off at different places. And then we arranged for them to come back in reverse route and pick them up when the vacation was over. So I thought, why don't we do the same thing here? I spoke to some of the men and said, yes, that's a good idea. So I got onto the coach, I booked the coach, arranged it all, and then Lieutenant Paradise, our troop commander, said, to ease the strain on the railways, we're going to split this into two. Half you'd go 1 week and half the next week. So I pointed out to him, said, my idea, it won't put any strain on the railways. Oh, sorry, it's too late now, it's all been done. And of course, I suppose I should have gone to him first and said, what about this? Anyway, we had to cancel it. But I think that perhaps those two things may have given the powers that be an idea that I was officer material. What else? Oh, yes. We went to firing camp. That was near the end of our course. It would be January, or was it February of 1940. It was very, very cold, and there was thick snow on the ground. And we were billeted in at Tawyn, North Wales, which is a holiday resort, but of course no holiday makers there. So we were billeted in a boarding house. I remember that the walls of the room that we were in were plain plaster. I think if they'd been wallpaper, it had been stripped off. And John Craigie, who I said was a commercial artist, he did a wonderful drawing of an anti-aircraft gun in action on the wall in charcoal. And the orderly officer coming round, he was very impressed with it. That's very good indeed. Now scrub it off! So we had to get rid of that. And there was no hot water and no baths there, and we were there for a week. So John and I decided we had to do something, so we stripped off and went into the sea. And the rest of the battery came out, wrapped up in their greatcoats, and watched us. Anyway, it was fine, and we came out and rubbed ourselves down afterwards, and that was fine.
What were you firing at firing camp?
Well, these were the 3.7 anti-aircraft, heavy anti-aircraft guns, and we would fire at a sleeve that was being towed behind a plane. And
and after this?
Well, after that, I was posted. And I was posted to the 3rd Battalion of the London Scottish, which was a territorial unit, and it was known as an officer-producing unit. And I got there, that was there in April 1940. I have a copy of the March edition of the London Scottish Gazette. And in it there's a section on the 3rd Battalion, and I can't remember the actual figures now, but I have got them down somewhere, about how many NCOs and other ranks went off for commissions. And it would be something like 40 or 50 altogether in the first few weeks of the year went off for commissions. And that was the general thing here. In fact, in the 3rd Battalion when I went there, I remember that Paul Dane, who was quite a well-known poet and writer, was one of the other ranks there, and he went off to an octu. And in the stores there was Gilbert Bonham Carter, one of the big Bonham Carter families. He went off to octu. And then into the bed next to me came Jimmy James, who's straight from the 6th form at Eton, and he went off to octu. So I was posted to this unit as an officer-producing unit.
Where was this?
This was in south of London. It was the headquarters was at Eltham, and we were on... where was it?
Not Shooter's Hill?
No, that came later. It'll come back to me. Anyway, it was just south of Eltham, the gun site was. St. Paul's Cray, that's right, it was at St. Paul's Cray. And I was sent for by the colonel, Colonel Carr, spelled with a K. And I went in for an interview, and he asked me two questions. He said, which school did you go to? I said, Rock Ferry High School, sir. And he took down a book, I was thinking it must have been a Whittaker's Almanac, and looked through it, and he said, I don't see it in the list of public schools. I said, no, sir, it was a grammar school. Did it have an officer training corps? No, sir. Dismiss. And so that's how I didn't become an officer then. I was put onto the job of teaching mathematics to the officers who were about to go off to octu, and it was mostly geometry and trigonometry. And I remember explaining to them how a height finder worked by using angles. We did actually have some action then, because I remember, of course, there was the Battle of France went on. None of that had really had any effect on us at all. We just went on doing what we were doing until the Battle of France and the defeat at and then the Dunkirk, the evacuation at Dunkirk, and that really did cause some problems. I mean, the first thing that happened that really affected us, all our rifles were withdrawn. the short magazine, the Enfield, the SMLE. And first thing, we had an order, I don't know where it came from, that we had to make koshes. I got a stick from somewhere, and I forget now, but it was a heavy weight fastened on the end, and I wrapped barbed wire around the end of it. But I don't know how we were supposed to repel a German invasion with weapons like that. Shortly later, we were issued with rifles. I had a Lee Metford, which I think had been used in the Boer War. And some of the others had some American rifles, which had been... They were .3 ammunition. That must have been left behind after the Great War. But we didn't have any ammunition for them. Anyway, I was on the Predictor, and I remember the first daylight raids, standing there. We were taking posts. We were all on the guns. I was on the Predictor, and looking up into the blue sky and seeing this great formation of German bombers. Perfect formation, flying high above us in the blue sky. Beautiful sight. And we didn't go into action. I have no idea why, but we were not ordered to fire. And then the next thing was when the nighttime raids came. And of course then we had to wait for a searchlight to pick out a plane, which it did sometimes, and we did actually go into some action with our heavy 3.6s. Oh yes. Before that, with so many men going off to commissions, replacements used to come in, and we had a lot of immatures posted in. These were from Glasgow, and they were young soldiers who had enlisted full-time, but were too young to go overseas. I think the government said that nobody under the age of 18 would be posted overseas, and these were all under 18. So they were sent to us, and they were real tough, rough Glaswegians. And really very badly disciplined. Now, the shells that we used were stacked near the guns, and each shell was fitted with a protective thing over the fuse called Fuse Caps FL. Now, the FL stood for French letter, which is what these were. And it was we noticed that whenever the immatures had some time off, some of these shells would lose their Fuse Caps FL. And we did wonder if the birth rate had gone up in that area at all. Anyway, but that was actually really before we went into this action.
What kind of success did you have against German planes?
I don't ever remember that we actually shot anything down. I think that probably what we were doing was splitting up the raiding formations, making them spread out. And of course, this was after the Battle of Britain, and we had seen some of the action of the Battle of Britain, but of course, with the RAF involved there was no point in the anti-aircraft firing at them, so we didn't really do anything then. But these were the later, the nighttime raids. But then in, I think it would be October, I was posted out, and I was posted to a Z battery. It was a troop of 129 AKAK Z battery. And we were introduced to our weapon, at least. I only ever saw one that was there. The other troops probably had theirs. And it was a rocket and a projector. Now, the projector consisted of two, what I suppose were tubular scaffolding, two bits of tubular scaffolding parallel, and the rocket would lie on the top of those. The rocket was another piece of tubular scaffolding, and it had a warhead at one end and fins at the other, and a Venturi tube at the rear. And this lay on these two parallel launching tubes, and it was fired by an electrical contact. And we were told that these were our answer to the Stuka dive bombers, which had caused a lot of havoc in France at the end of the war, at the end of the Battle of France. And the way we were to use them was the gunner would stand behind a Perspex screen, and on the screen was two vertical lines marked. And there was a strap which went round the back of the gunner's head. And he would pull the head, his head back until the strap was taut, and look through the two parallel lines. And when the Stuka was coming down, he would wait until the wingspan just fitted between the two lines on the Perspex screen, and then he would fire the rocket. I don't know that that particular method was ever used. I've never heard of it being used. We went off to firing camp, and we did fire some rockets, but not using that method. We simply fired at a sleeve.
Where was this Z battery?
I'm trying to remember. Again, it was somewhere south of London. I have got it written down, and I can't remember the actual place, but it was to the south of London, in Kent.
Somewhere in the Ultimarium.
Yes. But anyway, we
were you still under the London Scottish? Were you still part?
No, I'd been posted out of the London Scottish onto this Z battery. No, they'd obviously given up on my becoming an officer. So.
So this was an independent.
This was an independent battery, which meant it was not part of a regiment. It was simply a battery on its own. And we did go to firing camp, and we fired some of the rockets, but obviously not at a dive bomber. And then we came back, and we went to Nottingham. I don't know why.
Who went to Nottingham?
Well, the battery, the 129 XZ battery. We didn't see any more of the rockets or the rocket launchers at all. We came back from firing camp. We went to Nottingham. I remember coming out of the station, we marching through the streets, and it was great. The women there came out offering of cups and mugs of tea. I remember when drinking one, it had a lot more than tea in it. That was well laced. And we were put in some civilian billets there for a few days.
So this is the whole of your Z battery you had moved to Nottingham?
Yes, I think it must have been. Certainly it was A troop. I remember that going then, and I presume that the rest of the battery went as well, but I couldn't swear to that.
And are we still in 1940?
This is 1941 now, I'm sorry. Yes, it was December 1941 when we went to Nottingham, because I did get 7 days leave over Christmas from there.
December 1940?
Yeah. So we're now in January 1941. And then we were given a new role. We were fitted with Lewis guns. And these were to protect vital points. But I have to say now that in all the time that we had these Lewis guns, I never saw a German plane. But anyway, we were posted out to various places. We usually stay, 2-3 weeks in one place and then move on. It's actually, as far as I'm concerned, a very good arrangement, because there will be an NCO and four gunners. I wouldn't swear to that. It may have been six. Anyway, four gunners and a Lewis gun. And we were entirely independent. I mean, our rations would come. Once a week, an officer would come to pay us. But otherwise, we didn't see any officers. We were just there on the site. One of the sites was, the worst one, was at Swindon and the railway yards. And our particular gun position that I was on was over the coaling yard. So I'm afraid we got very dusty, and we spent a lot of time cleaning up ourselves and the Lewis gun. Another one was at Cowley, that's near Oxford, and presumably it was the motor works, the Morris Motor Works. And again, we were at Luton. That would be the Vauxhall Works, and there we were on what we call the doctor's site, which was the flat roof of a surgery. So we were on these guns. There were also some aerodromes, airfields, I beg your pardon. We One was at Upper Hayford, where I remember that they had Hamptons there, and the Hampton has a quite a large